want lawyers, aspiring lawyers to come back on time, threaten to build and bite them. And thank you for the introduction, and Bai, one of your volunteers at the back, read it. He said, "You've had an interesting career." Well, my dearest friend of 46 years and my wife of 40 years, by coincidence, are the same person. Wouldn't have been so generous. You've been taken for quite a ride today. And I have hoped to draw some sort of a thread to tie it all together, which is almost an impossible task because there are so many things about international humanitarian law that is connected to each other. So I think what I'll do is I will perhaps speak about international humanitarian law under an umbrella of international humanitarian law. In the program, it says, rules of war, question mark. I admit to bringing a certain bias and a passion to international humanitarian law, as well as human rights law. By accident of ethnicity, it was the liberal government of Mackenzie King, and I like to remind my liberal friends that it was Mackenzie King, who put on the internment in February of 1942, and finally left the restriction on the 1st of April 1949, 7 years later. But real liberation didn't come for us until the 22nd of September 1988, 46 years later, when the conservative government under Brian Mulroney apologized to the survivors of that internment. So here I am, liberated, to speak to you about international humanitarian law. So let's go back to the program, a question mark. The development, particularly in view of the changing nature of conflict, because the laws were crafted by the warrior society, helped by diplomats, academics, humanitarians, to put together or craft a body of law that would govern their behavior on the field of battle. And in those days, they didn't make a distinction whether it was international armed conflict or internal armed conflict. Much of it was internal. So my question to you is it still relevant today? That was the law at once. Or is it not? Well, now we have to hear your views. It's relevant. Why?
Though the technology has changed and the other circumstances have changed, but you have to keep the basic values intact. The basic values, respecting the people even in the battlefield. And those, if you divorce those core values from your even fighting tactics, then you won't be a man, you will be a wild person, you know?
Well, okay, so you are a single person, individual, speaking about core values.
Right.
Well, why should we take those core values and put them into law?
They served us well enough. These values have served us well.
Why? Why would they write them into law, or in the case of customary law, they're now written in text? But when you talk about treaty law, it applies to 194 signatories to the Geneva Convention. When you talk about customary law, it applies to everybody, whether you sign it on or not. So why should we do that? You know why, from my point of view? Because of our human failings, and that we need rules to govern our daily lives, whether it's in peace or in war. You know, when you see children playing by themselves, a game that they create their own rules, right? Because they want to enjoy that. Not that soldiers enjoy going to war. But as a peacekeeper, I have been witness incredible suffering. And regardless of the changing nature of conflict, like you, we have to regulate how the human race conducts the war. And this is an important beginning. This is the third iteration of an initiative taken on by Catherine. And Catherine took part in a military international humanitarian law course here with me a number of years ago. I think it was in 2004? Yeah. Okay, now I wrote a few things down here that I want to share with you. When we spoke about detainees in Afghanistan and their protection, let's go back to the Security Council resolution, which authorized the launch of Operation Enduring Freedom. Some of you may have seen footage of Canadian Joint Task Force 2 taking prisoners and turning them over to the U.S. to a system of questionable legal probity. No one has come back to that. But perhaps one day, one of those captains will come back to say, you, the Iranian government, had soldiers on the ground which put me into that system. And I finally liberated that system 20 years later, or 10 years later. Why did the government do that? I don't know. But have they asked the Canadian Red Cross, have they asked the ICRC, to get a third opinion outside of the legal branch about what rules ought to govern protection for detainees, they would have gotten the appropriate advice that would protect them. Because who's to say that once these folks were turned over to the U.S., that they're still alive today? Now, if you are a captain, not you, except for Chris and maybe some of you about the military service, there are laws governing protection of detainees, whether you're a prisoner or a detainee. What are the most vulnerable times for you? Imagine when you are facing imminent capture. What are the most vulnerable times?
Being transferred.
You're speaking to an old artillery once you've got to really speak. Although my wife says, I hear selectively.
Being transferred from one group to another.
Exactly. A very dangerous time. Any other time?
When you're needy, either hungry, thirsty, sleepy, afraid.
Yes, and that's a gift. And I suppose you wouldn't mind sharing them with me.
Immediately upon capture.
Immediately upon capture. Picture, if you will, you are in a tank or armored personnel carrier or a foxhole. You're shooting away. Your buddy gets grilled. Somebody else gets killed or wounded. And there is a belligerent putting his hands up, surrendering. Your normal inclination is to go. It's gone. But law prohibits that. Well, how do you prevent that? With good training, good leadership, and discipline. And it can happen. You know, in my time in Central Asia, from 1999 to 2001, my job was to sell a product nobody wanted, compliance with the Geneva Convention. And I was in contact with people who had served under the Soviet flag in Afghanistan. Because in the later years of the war, the bulk of the fighting fell to the Soviet republics. And I met officers who were very concerned about allowing their troops to take that one step to decline into savagery or the race to the bottom, as Isabel said. And now they're just to let it go. And I can tell you, those who get that grip are the ones who are respected today and who can hold their head high. And those who did not exercise discipline, command, leadership, are the ones, and in one case, I was that person's public confessor. He wanted to unload that guilt that he carried with him after all these years, the fact that he did not command as he should have. And he became one of the strongest supporters of the IHL program in Afghanistan. And they all served in the same army, the Soviet army. So they had friends in Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, working in those five stands, five of the 11 stands of the region. So there is still a place for international humanitarian law, and we should be strengthened by the breaches that were made by others so that we can promote it. Now, what you're doing here today, your introduction to international humanitarian law, as I see it, from a generational point of view, is it's an investment in our future leaders. I don't care if you're a prime minister or minister of defense or head of the International Criminal Court. Now you know that you can't assume that because you come from such a benign, open, welcoming society in Canada, you cannot assume that our police, military, will act in accordance with societal values when they are facing war. So, immediate upon capture. Second, transfer. People disappear during transfer. You know, when you have 20 captives, all with the name Mohammed, in a situation where you have the last name, how do you make that distinction and ensure that they are registered and they do not disappear? They do. And you collective you, members of the armed forces, members of police, Canadian in general, when the military takes a prisoner, it's important to record as much information as possible to ensure that there's some record of that individual. Because picture, if you will, if the adverse party took your mother or sister or father on from the captive without any record and that person disappeared, you would have that wound with you for the rest of your life. And that was very clear to me when I was involved with the ICRC in this simple project. People generations after the war who do not know the outcome of their loved ones. And that's another aspect of international humanitarian law that I hope you will have a chance to explore. It is fascinating and it's profoundly saddening. And in the days when I was involved in that, there were days I had to be in the archives. I could not be anymore. Now, just to make sure that I'm on track, at my age it's strange, but I have to take my glasses off to One of the interventions that came up here about how complex the situation is in Afghanistan. Yes, it is. But Afghanistan is not peacekeeping, it's war. There are four distinct entities in Afghanistan. First of all, there is United Nations Assistance Mission, which is there to reinforce a fledgling government to help them in accordance with their needs and not the needs as perceived by outsiders. Very difficult task. Secondly, Operation Enduring Freedom, the war against terrorism. Thirdly, the International Security Assistance Force, again under a UN mandate. And they're all there at the request of the Afghan government to help them become a stable country where they can grow. And fourthly, the Afghan government. And too often, when you talk about, say, putting in a regime to protect detainees, it is an outside template that is being imposed on what is largely a tribal society governed by the Quran and Sharia law. But having said that, a template that outsiders can bring can reach coincidence with the internal template because without being corrected, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, "The captive is your brother. Do not demand more of him than you would demand of yourself. Instead, help him accomplish his task." And that is a very powerful message that I use to piggyback my dissemination program of international humanitarian law. And that should inform how the societies, the nations that are there to assist Afghanistan should be recalibrating their assistance. First of all, you are meeting the needs of the Afghan government in accordance with the Afghan compact and how they want it. And yes, in the process, you have to deal with some fairly unsavory characters. And Minister of Interior was absolutely corrupt. And that Minister of Interior and the Prosecutor General are responsible for detaining or holding people under detention. But you have to start somewhere. You know, we living in the country of the Western world know that there is a certain judicial guarantee when people are taken in custody by the police. Usually. Those guarantees are sometimes very tenuous in a fledgling society. Now, protection. When we spoke about detainees, protection has a larger dimension. And under the rubric as it were, protection, Isabel mentioned tracing. Reuniting people who are separated by conflict or by natural disasters. And when we are successful in reuniting people, it doesn't matter whether Isabel or I are having to do with it. It's a joy that we all share because we know the system works. Somebody was separated from their parents, and I remember a couple of years ago, our head coordinator in Toronto delivered a news to a Congolese woman that her two daughters had been found. Because during a certain part of the war, her husband disappeared, so the outcome there is unknown. She had an infant daughter, $200 at school, couldn't come home and escape. She escaped and mentioned it in Canada. 3 years later, through the tracing system of the ICRC, Congolese Red Cross, Canadian Red Cross, we were able to determine the identity of these two girls living in the camp. And they're kind. I think now they are physically joined. And it's a joy that we share with the people who are involved. I had a similar experience in Uzbekistan when we were able to rejoin a 12-year-old Afghan boy with his mother and two sisters. They had been separated for 6 years after Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, escaped, and ended up in a refugee camp in Kyrgyzstan. They were reunited in Karachi and off they went to the States. But everything is not joyful. There's also a sad side to reuniting families separated by conflict. After the war between Iran and Iraq, 8 years for children were used in the final days of the war. Came the ceasefire, and I was an observer on the Iran-Iraq ceasefire line when Saddam chose to invade Kuwait, and things got a bit messy after that. In any case, when the Gulf War started, the ICRC was able to seek the release of some of the prisoners that had not been on the ICRC list. And then, during the current Gulf War, the ICRC was able to do the same. And picture, if you will, a young man in his 40s, who was captured when he was in his late 20s. He came home to Baghdad hoping to reunite with his parents. But his parents were gone. He didn't know whether they had died or had moved somewhere else. Well, thanks to the Iraqi Red Crescent, the German Red Cross, ICRC, his parents had been accepted as refugees in Germany. And he had a difficult decision to make. Would he leave a society that he knows, or would he go into an uncertain future to join his parents? But he chose to join his parents. Again, a happy ending. Less happy is a case of a man who came home, hoping to reunite with his wife, and then married maybe 2 or 3 weeks before he went to the front lines. He's captured. 15 years later, he comes back to discover that his wife had immigrated to the U.S. She had immigrated because the government of Saddam Hussein had declared him dead. They connected all right, only for him to discover that she had remarried. So how do you reconcile? These are difficult things to face. The very human condition, the very human faces behind the so-called dry text of international humanitarian law. Okay, now, from mines to cluster munitions. We've come a long ways. When the international campaign to ban landmines began in the late 80s and early 90s, quite separate from this was an international conference hosted by the ICRC in Lausanne. The intent was not only to take ICRC war surgeons, but war surgeons from other humanitarian organizations to come and share surgical and other techniques to help victims of armed conflict. The unintended consequence of that particular conference in 1993 was the overwhelming consensus among surgeons and medical professionals that landmines as a weapon of war wasn't here and not here then. And that's when the ICRC really got onto it and began its own process. And I'm happy to say that I was privileged to be part of that process in the landmine study in 95-96 on the Ottawa Treaty and post-treaty activities. So we've come a long ways. In those days, cluster munitions and unexploded ordnance of war was very much on the agenda. But we couldn't risk the landmines by bringing in other dimensions. I submit to you today that time is right to talk about cluster munitions. But here I think we can be very specific. As Chris mentioned, under the category of cluster munitions, we have canisters that dispense chaff, that dispense propaganda. I think they're rather benign, but cluster munitions with the explosive content, particularly the shaped charge, is the one that causes incredible injury. Back in 1995, I worked very briefly at the International Criminal Tribunal performing a slot as a technical analyst, technical advisor. Then in 96, I returned to do a field investigation over the bombing of Zagreb, where the lunar rockets, six of them, had impacted on the city. And my investigation with the team revealed that none of the intended targets would constitute a military object. Second, the devastating effects of the 264 submunitions in the lunar rockets caused civilian fatalities immediately upon impact, and in the years to follow, with children picking up things that are about a third of the size of this coffee cup, and they have a tab on it. Sometimes the tabs are fluorescent colored, which makes it easier to recover the unexploded ordnance. But these tabs are designed to provide the drag so that cluster munition will land like that on the target, and the shaped charge, which is sort of concave, will burn a hole into a tank, an armored personnel carrier, or an artillery piece. That's how they function. But in some cases, the failure rate is as high as 40%. Even self-destruct munitions. And if these munitions that continue to wreak havoc on humans that have nothing to do with conflict in the first place, I hope to reach a stage where we can have another treaty, perhaps a protocol to the Ottawa Treaty, that will see these cluster explosive munitions banned forever. And what is interesting to me is that when you look at the 1980 CCW Convention, it was done with the new UN system. And there are certain weaknesses, as you all know, because the UN is political body. But when you look at the Ottawa Treaty, those who were the motivating force behind this treaty knew the weakness and the limits of the UN system. And so that treaty was crafted outside the normal UN system, the Ottawa Treaty. And that's a good one. It's quite amazing that like-minded individuals without political baggage can achieve that in the name of humanity. We spoke about non-state armed actors. Yes, there are other issues under the IHL umbrella that we have to come to grips with. Children affected by armed conflict. When the additional protocols were being negotiated in 1977, the time was not propitious to raise the minimum age from 15 to 18 without putting the entire protocol negotiation system at risk. And therefore it was accepted at that time. And I submit to you these days that it's time to go back and open up that file again. Another thing that is really important to consider is regulating the arms traffic. After every conflict, arsenals fall into the wrong hands. And even if there is no conflict, arsenals still fall into the wrong hands. Picture, if you will, my 2.5 years in Central Asia, the Soviet Union had collapsed, and it left behind tons and tons of ammunition and arsenals that were never used. But what do you think? The mines and mortar bombs and artillery shells, where are they today? Well, they disappeared into the arms bazaar. So we have to regulate that. Dealing with non-state armed actors can be a real challenge. First of all, if dealing with them at the field level is concerned, that's the security of the people who are involved. The NCRCW has gotten to non-state armed actors. And these things do happen. And when the talks reach a certain stage, it's time to move to a much more secure venue. So the key is to secure parties that can guarantee a secure venue where discussions can take place. But in the process of dealing with these non-state armed actors, you have to ask yourself, do they have the political maturity to respect the agreements that they reach into, that they agree to? Secondly, if they don't, you're dealing with them. Are you giving them a legitimacy that they want, but they're not quite ready to assume? And thirdly, what about the host nation in which you conduct your operations? Most host nations do not allow outsiders to come in and negotiate with the farm people within their sovereign borders. So there are some real practical considerations. But having said that, though, I think it's public knowledge now that the ICRC deals with about 40 such groups. Principally, to ensure safe access to victims of conflict. Okay. I think I'll close now and let you pose questions. But maybe a closing comment I have is that human ingenuity has been just incredibly imaginative and productive in designing weapons of war. I wonder if there's any way we can harness that same ingenuity to reduce or eliminate conflict and to dispel the hatred and the fear that is taught to successive generations, as Amelia well knows. It's not just in the form of Islam, everywhere. We teach our children to hate and to be suspicious. And therefore, when we talk about a post-conflict situation, we won't really see the return on investment until the next unborn generation. And the lasting thought that I have with respect to international humanitarian law, think in imaginative ways how you can operationalize, as it were, the principles of IHL, namely limitation, in other words, limit the means and methods of warfare, distinction, the principle of distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants, the principle of proportionality, and the principle of military necessity. So the floor is yours. Before I open the floor, I might call on my friend Bill to respond to some of your questions, and I also want to acknowledge Professor Ian McAllister. He has this matrix called capabilities and vulnerabilities. And that's the same matrix that we could use at the Peace Center in the 1990s, and it's the same matrix that I used in Pakistan last year when the earthquake began to cover the operations when I headed up the operations for the Federation. It's a very useful tool, Ian. Thank you very much.
Can I?
Ask us the question and then sort of get an answer. One of the challenges that I've been noticing a lot lately is what I call the rogue state challenge, where the rogue state isn't in Iraq or whatever. It's a major power that isn't in fact signing an agreement, or if it's not signing an agreement, or it has signed it as opposed to keeping it. And what is starting point for the United States government at the moment on Guantanamo Bay, and then moving from Guantanamo Bay, the fact that the United States government hasn't actually signed the mining convention. And for reasons which are quite explicable, in one might say a lack of context. And here we have, right today, a rather similar financial situation with Canada not signing the original agreement, which is just being bought. It raises to my mind the role of an organization like, say, the Canadian Red Cross as partner to the American Sea and with many friends in the American Red Cross. We seem to my mind to be sort of sitting rather passively decide the situation, whether to be particularly advocate role. And I just wonder how this, I realize the complications of this, but I wrote recently in something, I wondered if Henri Dunant, who was back today, could actually join the Canadian Red Cross. Whether you might go into a business assignment. That's a devil's advocate. How do you see this U.S. relationship?
That's an incredibly good question because, if only Ron were here today, he would, you know, Richard, he'd still be a pauper. I suspect, because his humanitarian heart affected his business decisions. In any case, first of all, I would not expect the Canadian Red Cross or the American Red Cross to take an advocacy role on political issues unless it's in behalf of existing or potential victims. To do so outside of that really violates the principle of neutrality. So that is limited. This isn't to say that both societies could not engage in a constructive way in ongoing debate. That will always be the case. In the case of the US, I think you have to take a long-term view. The administration is there for either 4 or 8 years. And I think many people will be happy when the 8 year rolls around, regardless of who comes in behind. I'm reminded of a dear colleague who's an American lawyer. And when George Bush said, they're guilty, move on, and whether they're dead or alive, he said to me, you'll go down in history, all right, in U.S. history, as the only president that played football without a helmet. She was so angry. No? How could you say that as president of my country? Boy, I didn't elect you. Anyways, putting it on the context, let's look at some examples from very recent history. 1979 and the student revolution in Iran. There is a sovereign responsibility on the part of the Iranian government to protect embassies. Embassies situated on ground that belongs to the sovereign nation that is represented. In accordance with the Warsaw and the Vienna Conventions that govern diplomatic relations, there is an obligation. But the government of Iran chose not to do anything about it. And the students took over the rest of the system. Now fast forward by a couple of years to the Falklands War, 1982. Both sides were scrupulous about respect for international humanitarian law. And when there was a suggestion of any breaches, they were very quick to investigate, and where there were grounds, they could prosecute. There was a public transparent process. Prisoners were treated in accordance with international humanitarian law. That led to resumption of full diplomatic relations a mere 12 years later. And 28 years later, Iran is still isolated. In the case of the US, the very support is somewhat lukewarm, and perhaps other nations will indicate likewise. But they know that in a couple of years from now, George Bush won't be there. So it's going to take a bit of time. Because how do you, when Clinton signs on to the Rome statutes, how do you unsign something like that? And then you enter into this exercise of part of the 98 exemptions. Well, there you're extra billions in aid if you come aboard with part of the 98 exemptions. And how cynical can that be? It doesn't serve the purpose for the US to do that. And yet, there's nobody that has a strategic vision for this great power when the critical way, the diplomatic goodwill that existed after 9/11, it's gone. Totally gone. And we are all cooler for it. Most of all, the US. That doesn't really answer your question, but it does raise a number of issues for all of you to dispute what I say, or dispute what Ian says, or even to your own discussion. It's really important to keep these discussions going. Because with the comfort of discussion comes greater familiarity. And when you're talking about taboo subjects, if you talk about it often enough, it becomes comfortable. You know, last week I was in Amman, and I was hosted by, at the end of my engagement, I was hosted by the Jordan River Foundation. And the patriarch there is Queen Rania, who was a Palestinian. And here there is a distinct mandate dealing with victims of sexual abuse. And the victims are all girls. Abused by their fathers, uncles, grandfathers. And here, in a conservative Muslim society, it's incredible that they would speak about it by their openly. I didn't see that back in 1991. So here it is, 16 years later, suddenly open. They are much more enlightened. Go back to Pakistan. I just left there last year. And do you think that anybody would acknowledge the existence of homosexuality in that country? No way. Until they do, the spread of HIV/AIDS as a result of unprotected sex And as a result of drug abuse, it's going to continue spiraling. And as a Red Cross, I know what can do that. We can put a dent in the growth of people that are infected by HIV AIDS. The nation itself is not quite ready to acknowledge. So on one hand, you see growing enlightenment, and on the other, still there.
I just want to speak to the public advocacy piece, and I think it's probably something that's useful for all of us. I've always thought that you need three key ingredients to conduct effective public advocacy campaigns or initiatives, and one of them is research, and more research. The second one would be media engagement, and the third one would be community engagement. And unfortunately, the Kenya Clock on the first front has not had, for a variety of reasons in the last 10 years, a policy and research function. And so therefore, in my view, you cannot conduct meaningful advocacy representation if you don't have that research and policy function. So I guess I'm pleased share with you and with others that the Kenya Cross is certainly moving into that direction in terms of bolstering and harnessing its policy capacity, because we get a lot of support from the Federation and the SDRC in terms of policy products and materials, but there are policy issues that are unique to Canada that we need to tackle ourselves. So I think we're traveling on that road slowly but surely.
No, for sure. And I have to say that I'm a volunteer with the Red Cross, and will continue the volunteer services of the second part of the principles of our movement, Red Cross for Cross movement. Anyone ever challenge what I said or dispute it? I really appreciate that. Because if I could agree with that, it's so wise.
You know, Canada has the image of traditional peacekeeper. It's a traditional image. So is Canada now running a race for becoming a superpower? Like, it's not, to be honest, right?
We need at least two tanks.
There's no need to, you know, transform from that image of being a traditional peacekeeper for the peace, aiding and rebuilding the country, to going into the active war, you know, being accomplice of the US. And also, if you talk on like rebuilding the other nations, one is that we have responsibility to contribute in terms of financial assets, to contribute in terms of technology and stuff. Why the need is there to send our people there, you know, because there's poverty all over the world. These are the key issues we need to tackle instead of, you know, going to the fighting and other stuff. And I think we are heading towards the situation of like colonial rule, you know, like putting colonies all over the world and being accomplished with that. So it's something, you know, not clear that what the Canada is trying to do.
In one respect, I think we suffer from a clear foreign defense policy, because it's difficult to craft one when there is so much partisan bickering. When I look at Norway as an example, even when governments change, their foreign policy very rarely changes because it's crafted in such a way that all parties, regardless of who's in power, will track a particular policy. Having said that, though, when you look at the nature of conflict, First World War, when the ICRC formally got the agreement of the belligerents to visit prisoners of war, prior to them doing that, yes. Not published with the acquiescence of the issues. In 1915, they started. In that war, 90% of the casualties were military and 10% civilians. By the time of the Second World War, it was half and half. Today, over 90% are civilians. So the nature of conflict has changed dramatically. And the last international conflict ended about 3 years ago when the war between Eritrea and Ethiopia ended. So, although there is less conflict in the world today, those conflicts tend to be within a state. And it's quite a remarkable phenomenon, because when you look at Europe, you have 27 nations that are in the process of unification. which means that they're giving up an element of sovereignty, independence, and everything else to become a better cohesive whole. In other parts of the world, you see disintegration, and with that comes conflict. Now, what's Canada's role? What's Canada's role in it? Well, in the case of Afghanistan, there's an obligation when the Security Council passes a resolution under Chapter 7. That is a legal obligation. That's why Canada is there. Now, the politicians can't tell you that because it's difficult to sell a war-fighting mission unless you put a humanitarian cast on it. So they've done that, but it's out of proportion to what is required now because none of the humanitarian part will ever take off until you get the security situation sorted out first. And that's going to take a bit of time. Already, the level of conflict is declining because the war seems to come to an end. And it'll stay quiet for the winter, and maybe next year, conflict will erupt again. But one would hope that the intensity of that conflict would be not as high as it was last summer or the summer before. It is a humanitarian challenge, and if we don't help promote peace and stability, it will come to our doors. Globalism has nothing to do with it. And it is our acceptance in that we are a former colony, that we have no colonial past that makes us more acceptable for either military or humanitarian intervention in various parts of the world. It puts us in a very good position. It doesn't make us super. And as the process of rebuilding the forces goes on, you'll have more and more resources to engage in a much more robust way in situations that require, first of all, the establishment of a secure and stable environment.
I got at least 100 questions, but I'll save them on. This one was brought this up earlier. She mentioned that applicability in the Charter is from the prohibition on Haiti. So, wide open Haiti, right?
Haiti.
H-A-T? Oh, never heard of Haiti. Okay, so an unrelated, totally unrelated question, totally subject matter. But I guess about Canada's identity and the vote of Haiti. What do you do? Like, I don't know, so I'm asking. What are you doing in Haiti? What's going on there? Are you doing good things there, bad things? Who's there? What are you going to be there until this first day?
Well, I would say that Haiti continues to be a master. It's the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. Also, I was there in the mid-1990s when the mandate was inadequate. The mandate was not sufficiently inclusive to build, develop, and build enough capacity. And so it went through a period of 10 years and it reverted back to violence. And now the intent is to put a cap on that violence, and Canada's contribution is principally in the police role. Nothing will happen in any country or area riven by conflict unless you establish fundamentally the rule of law and help build a system of governance and all the institutions and processes that go with it. How are we going to get there? Well, you have to still deal with some unsavory characters, but that's all you've got. You've got to make it work with the resources you have at hand. With a view to perhaps in 10 years' time, there'll be change of the old guard, new guard, ongoing process where incrementally the process of democratization will take hold. In the 1990s, mid-1990s, the problem that Haiti had was compounded by the international community because every government wanted to be seen by the electorate to do some good. And yet the country has a finite absorptive capacity. So putting more money into it is going to help, it's going to complicate it, it's going to encourage corruption, graft, and that's what it did. And the bad news is that the situation hasn't changed a great deal because Haitians themselves, particularly the upper class, have not reinvested in their country. The Haitian diaspora have not come back to build their country. But by contrast, when you look at Afghanistan, the Afghan diaspora, some of them have come back because they believe in their country. And the money that's generated, whether it's drug money or other legitimate money, pretty well stays in the country. So that's the difference. So, is there hope for Haiti? I believe there is. When I first went there, I had two of the national prison And in there, men, women, and children were all lumped together, and people found places to sleep, and most of the time they weren't in places to sleep. They just stacked in there. And you can imagine, without dividing people between those who are sentenced, those who are under investigation, those who are waiting trial, separating men, women, and children, you can imagine the abuse that took place. A couple of years later, the women were gone. They were in a separate detention facility. And some facility it was. They didn't have a door that even locked. They didn't need it. Families would come in and out to deliver food, fresh laundry, and whatnot. The guard at the gate wasn't even armed. And a year later, when I went back, more good news, that kids who were in the national penitentiary had been moved in with the women. In this entire process, all the detainees were also registered. So there were fewer and fewer disappearances and extrajudicial killings. Not that it's going to disappear entirely, you can't get it wrong. But the fact that now the National Penitentiary has cells and certain blocks where there's nothing for people to sleep, they have a kitchen facility, a medical facility, a dental facility, speaks volumes about how well assistance in the international community was used. Unfortunately, that's only one part of the reform of the judicial system, because when you look at the pillars of the justice system, police, correction services, initially, we looked after the correction. We're struggling with police, and the judiciary is still a long duration on the reform. But you can't handle one, you have to handle them all at the same time, including security sector reform. And underpinning all this, of course, is economic reform. And yet, the greatest need is one for a secure and stable environment. And economic reform cannot come until you have education, but education won't come until you have a secure and stable environment. Complex. Yes, indeed. I've never been in a simple emergency. Every emergency I've gone through has been complex.
No doubt. So, what does that mean in real life when you say we have to right now team up with unsavory characters?
Do we want to know? People who are quite big saying, yeah, we're going to do what you do, but you know, it's going to cost you. Because I have to facilitate you, and I have to go and have to this, and I have certain expenses, etc., etc. You don't know how to afford it. Or those who have what appears to be an unsavable project, budget and everything else, and they take the entire money, and those that need are not getting done. They could have fiscal controls in place, but they don't get money until you see progress. Those are the countries that they do. Or characters who are connected to the criminal element, who they will contract to put you out of circulation if you stand in the way. So it's not a particular safety environment, but these are some of the factors that have to do it. And, you know, the integrity of the Red Cross that person, whether they deserve it or not, the uniformity and consistently increasing this aspect. Doesn't matter whether the reality is a gardener or a minister, treat them equally with respect. That's how we do it in ICRC. And over a period of time, it's grudgingly due to exception.
Just one final question?
Not a question, but a comment. When I first heard about this conference, I thought it sounded kind of interesting. And for $15, even if I got a good lunch, I wasn't out anything. So I just want to congratulate everyone involved in organizing the speakers. I haven't looked at my watch all day. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Thank you for your questions, your interventions. It's great.
There's one final question.
Oh, sir?
Yeah. I just wanted to know, in Michael Byers' book, Contempt for the Nation, he brings up one of the problems he sees in the Canadian military is that it works too hand in glove with the American military, and therefore we are dragged into military situations which he doesn't feel represent the wants of the Canadian people, largely because our defense budget goes into providing a certain style of military that doesn't necessarily lend itself to missions that he believes Canadians really want to see Canada on, and instead we end up in more combat-oriented missions. Do you have an opinion on that?
Michael Myers?
Yes. Is that you?
I just have an opinion on Michael
Myers. Yes, I do. Any questions? it's remarkable that he would reach those conclusions, because when you look at Canadian deployments overseas, all right, there's always a legal basis for it, unlike the Americans and the entering to Iraq. So I don't know where he's coming from. Fundamentally, if there's no legal basis for it, we're not going to be there. And yes, we are close to the Americans because no one of our names. And to me, that makes sense that if you have an off-shelf military item that is used for a Canadian mission, well, who cares? That'll be cheaper. You know, it's not that we're going to be Americans, yes. We also have exchanges with the Brits and the New Zealanders and Australians and French and Germans. Yes. But Americans are our neighbors. That's a lot. Yes.
Yeah, just to follow up on that a bit, I guess there are two underlying assumptions that are both of which are, in my position, perhaps overstated. And the first is that we are not a fighting country, that our military is a peacekeeping only focus, and that's never been the case. I mean, peacekeeping is an extraordinary part of the recent Canadian military culture and what the country is, but Canada was a major player in the First and Second World Wars in Korea. We had during the Cold War up to 10,000 people in Germany preparing not for peacekeeping but for World War III. And thankfully we didn't have to fund it. But there's a theme there as well as peacekeeping that I think is important to keep in mind. But the two conflicts I didn't mention there, going to Ted's point, are Vietnam and Iraq. And there were clear political choices there to not go. And so I think it's difficult to make that argument that we're in lockstep, that combat in general is somehow when it's necessary, it happens, and hopefully it's not necessary.
And in the case of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia in the 1960s, we were part of a tripartite organization responsible for monitoring outside the UN system.
So, Isabella, I've just come up with maybe a rather silly idea, but I have a great idea for Canadian Red Cross and IHL dissemination. I think we need a world map, and regardless of the region, I'm sure a Ted Itanic could pop up. When I was there on the border, and that's okay, I just have a few items left, and then you're free to go. While I'm talking, I'm just going to submit an evaluation for today. And again, please be frank and honest with your experiences today, suggestions you have for future conferences. Did you like the food? Did you like the line of speakers? What recommendations you have? We really listen. We really appreciate a lot based on last year's feedback, so we really do hear what you have to say. So please feel free to let us know how we did. And secondly, I just wanted to comment too. I really appreciate the feedback that I received personally. But I do want to tell you that I have the luxury of being paid to do what I do. I love my job. I'm very, very fortunate to work in this field. But I worked with a whole group of volunteers, and it was definitely a team effort. And so I just want to let you know that this was really student and volunteer driven, and I had a minimal part in the whole funding process. It was really a team effort. So you heard my name quite a bit, but really it was our larger team that contributed to today. So I want to make sure that that's really included. So thank you. I just want to talk about three ways. I just want to reiterate again that Nancy alluded to the fact that the MAP petition is available. I think you have copies in here as well as outside, so feel free to peruse that. I wanted to also let you know as far as further action and ways that you can get involved. For example, the group of university students and young professionals that helped plan this conference also drafted a draft pledge for the Canadian Red Cross, which Isabel is now revising and editing, that will be presented at the International Conference in November of States and Red Cross National Societies and Red Cross and Red Crescent Movement on clusters. So this team of people in Halifax played a large role in helping Isabel write a draft or write a pledge on clusters. So that was a way in which they were certainly involved. And secondly, you'll notice on the back of your program, I snuck in a little way in which you can volunteer with the Canadian Red Cross Humanitarian Issues Program. And I just want to quickly tell you about that. So it's quite a commitment and quite extensive training. Our group is university students, young professionals. We meet weekly, Wednesday nights. This week we're starting Monday night at 6 o'clock at the sub entrance just for a brief orientation of the whole sort of year's plan. And it really is every year directed by the students and young professionals who make up this group. We look at issues related to IHL, children, child soldiers, landmines, clusters. The group sort of takes on, evolves as we go throughout the year. We have guest speakers, specific trainers come in, and we constantly explore these issues and go in high school classrooms and do workshops with younger youth, as well as plan community events. So it's a really action-oriented group. Again, it's a weekly commitment to the team. And I really encourage, if this is an area of interest for you, that you contact me ASAP, because Monday night was starting at 6 o'clock at the Dallas sub at the entrance if you want further information. So it's a great way. Most of our volunteers from this group have gone on to incredible work with UN, with ICRC, various internships. We have, every year someone goes on a MAC internship from this working group to do work on landmine-related issues. So I really encourage you to consider that. So thank you very much for coming today, and please again feel free to share your feedback and just leave them at the front of the room, please, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.